I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Jane Christmas joins me again, the best-selling author, has been on twice before with her terrific memoirs, What the Psychic Told the Pilgrim and Incontinent on the Continent, the former, a book about an 800-kilometer trek she took with a bunch of other women in Spain. The latter was a memoir where Jane recounts taking her elderly mother on a six-week road trip across Italy. She has a new book to be published shortly, and Then There Were Nuns, Adventures in a Cloistered Life. She looks at monastic life and whether she's nun material. I'll ask her about this book, what led her to wanting to explore the nun's life, what was going on in her own life that provoked this exploration, and what's come about from all of it. Jane Christmas, like her parents, pursued a career in journalism, and then she started writing these books, the first of which came out over a decade ago, The Peely Project. They're really great books, insightful, a lot of fun, really thoughtful and thought-provoking and delightful. I can't wait to read this new one, which is published by Greystone. Visit janechristmas.ca. Please welcome back to the Plant Online program, Jane Christmas. Miss Christmas, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Pretty good yourself.
Fine, thank you, Joe.
In terms of this book, and I haven't read it yet, but I told you just before we started, I'm really looking forward to it, because if it's going to be like your previous books, it's going to be a lot of fun, and because you're such a great writer. I read somewhere that you were compared to I guess they called you Canada's Nora Ephron.
Isn't that something?
Yeah.
I don't know. That's high praise for sure.
Yeah.
So I'm
really looking forward to this because I'm curious to know. I mean, you've had more than one marriage behind you.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, you've got three kids, right?
Yes, that's right.
What made you want to look into pursuing a nun's life? I mean, was it pursuing a nun's life for the sake of doing it or for the sake of, say, fodder for a book?
Oh, no, absolutely. In fact, first of all, to go back to the first part of the question, I had been yearning to do this since I was a teenager. For some reason, and I don't know how it happened, but I just became seized with the idea of wanting to join religious life. I wanted to be a nun. And, of course, this was like the 60s and the early 70s, and people just didn't talk about it. If anything, society was moving away from organized religion and in fact, heaping a lot of scorn on it. And so for me to say that I wanted to be a nun just, I think, would just put me on the outer fringes of weirdness with my friends. And also, I didn't exactly present as a nun. I was a bit of a hippie and liked and still like sort of loud heavy metal music and, you know, just colorful clothes and that whole sort of lifestyle. And so I think I didn't sort of look the part, and I was a little bit of a profane type of person too, and I, you know, liked to go out with my friends and have a few beers and swear and everything like that. So, I mean, so I wasn't your typical nun or wannabe nun. But something seized me about religious life, and I've always felt close to God. I've always felt there was something beyond our life, and I always thought it was rather wonderful that people devoted themselves, their whole lives, to finding God and conversing with God and being sort of a source of prayer. So it was in that context that I wanted to pursue religious life. And, of course, I never did pursue religious life. I mean, that, like you said, I went down the path to journalism and into marriage and home ownership and divorce and raising children. But always through those periods, the thought of joining religious life always percolated. It was always there. And I remember thinking once when my children were acting up and it was just becoming so crazy, and I just remember thinking to myself, yep, I should have been a nun, but I didn't. I just, you know, kept going. I persevered, and it wasn't until my children did finally leave the nest and launch themselves into society that I had the time and no encumbrances. Nothing was sort of weighing on me, or I didn't have any commitments to people, really. And so there was the possibility was there that I could, in fact, become a nun now. And so I decided that it was now or never, and I went off and went to look into it.
I'm a Catholic, but not a good enough Catholic to know the answer to this. But are there orders where one can have been previously married, have children even, and still become a nun?
Well, I think it depends on the orders, because I'm an Anglican. I'm not Roman Catholic, but although I was raised as a Catholic, in a Catholic and an Anglican household, my parents had a mixed marriage. Uh-huh. And but there are Anglican nuns, and people find it hard to believe that they're Anglican nuns because you don't really hear that much about them. And in some of the Catholic orders that I have been to, encountered, they would not accept. I don't think they would accept divorced women into religious life, into the community. And yet, in some of the Anglican ones I've been to, there are women who are grandmothers who are nuns now, and they've either, you know, they've been divorced, or their husbands have passed away, their children have grown, and they've decided to become nuns. So it can happen. I think it's just each community is different, and I think Anglican ones are a little more relaxed than the Catholic ones. But maybe there are Catholic orders, enlightened Catholic orders, where you can be divorced and be a nun.
And as some of the other nuns that I've encountered, and usually on sitcoms, like I saw an episode of Mary Tyler Moore recently, where Georgette wants to become a nun, and so she's talking to a nun about what she needs to join, and she's one of those nuns. She was one of those nuns that they don't wear the uniform, if you will. And so there are, I guess, groups that don't, right?
That's right.
And they're more liberal in that sense.
Yeah, and it is up to each community to decide. Now, I mean, I can tell you there were two Anglican communities I can think of now. One of them wears the habit all the time, and they've tried to, I think even the Reverend Mother of the community has tried to get her fellow sisters to, you know, put aside their habits and wear civvies, and they flatly refuse to do it. Huh. And yet there's this other community of sisters that I know of in Toronto, and they hardly wear their habits. They're in civvies all the time. You would really, you know, it'd be very difficult to pick them out in a crowd, you know, who's the nun and who isn't the nun. Yeah. So, it depends on communities.
So what was happening in your life that compelled you to look into this seriously? I know you'd been in a long-term relationship with Colin. And did he propose before or after that you decided to...
No, you know, we had this long-distance relationship, and so at the time he was living in England and I was still in Canada, and I was working. And, you know, when you're apart from your partner for a long time, I mean, you think of different things and different scenarios and what's going to happen in your life and so on. And because you don't have a day-to-day relationship with someone, you know, there's a lot of stuff that just sort of you think about, but you don't share it with your partner. And I decided that this was something that I really wanted to do, and Colin had not been forthcoming about getting married. In fact, he sort of seemed to not be particularly fond of the idea. And I thought, wow, maybe he doesn't love me enough to want to marry me, or maybe this relationship is not going to work out, and you know, there were just all sorts of things. But then I thought, why am I worrying about the relationship so much? I should be worrying about what I want to do with my life, and not have my, I don't want my life to be dictated by what somebody is or isn't going to do, or I'm not going to sit around and wait for somebody to make up their mind. And so I started pursuing it on my own, and I thought, well, when I see Colin next, I will tell him what I've been doing. And but things seemed to pick up speed very quickly, and so I just sort of kept going and going and going, and then I thought, well, when I see him, I'm going to tell him. When the next time I see him, I'll tell him that I'm going to test my vocation. And so I was really, it was, you know, a day where we were, you know, we were checking out. I think it was like Boxing Day or something like this. And we were getting ready to leave the hotel we were staying in so we could go and see his parents. And I was sort of working it up in my mind going, okay, how, we've passed Christmas Day now, and now it's Boxing Day, so I'm going to have to tell him. And I was trying to formulate the words in my head of what I was going to say, and then suddenly he grabbed my hand and then proposed. And it was just, you know, sort of one of those things. But I had so convinced myself that this was what I was meant to do, that I needed to really suss this thing out. That I would marry him or accept his proposal. But when I flew back to Canada, I really felt a great sadness and thought I was kind of cheating myself. And so I phoned him up and just said, this is really what I want to do, and this is what I meant to tell you. And he said, well, then you need to go off and do it. And so that's what happened.
And then we I guess if we read the book, we can find out what happens between the two of you, right?
That's right.
Yeah. Now, so it's a year-plus journey that you took to, investigate all these?
Yes. It was that. I mean, it was in my mind. It was launched in my mind for a lot longer period, I guess. But I think from the moment that I said, okay, I'm going to do this, I'm really going to check it out, then it was probably, it was close to 2 years, I guess.
So you visited four communities.
Yeah. There was one in Canada, so one in Toronto. It's the only Anglican community in Canada. It's called the Sisterhood of St. John the Divine. And then there is, the only Anglican community for women.
Mm-hmm.
There are others, but this is sort of a maiden, this was the Made in Canada community. Before, there were other ones were branches of English communities or American ones. And then I went to England, and I went to a monastery on the Isle of Wight, and then for a week, and then to a Catholic convent also on the Isle of Wight for a week. And then I went up to Whitby in North Yorkshire, and stayed with them for 3 months. So there was that section, and the one in Toronto was, I think that was, I was there for a month, and but also going back and forth between them after that month too. So yeah, all in all, it was sort of a long journey and very rigorous as well, I might add.
Physically, spiritually, emotionally, and all that, right?
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. You do not, and it's not that it was mean or anything like that, and it wasn't discipline as in a harsh discipline, but I think we've become so accustomed to leading the lives that we want to live any way we want to live, like we can do whatever we want, whenever we want, and when you're adhering to a very strict schedule and a strict set of beliefs, it's a completely different kettle of fish.
So what does one need to be a nun? I mean, you obviously have to have some sort of devotion, celibacy, I think that's a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure there are people that try it out like you did and then figure out this isn't for me or I'm not cut out for it. So I'm mm-hmm. curious to know what one needs.
Yeah, that's a good, that's a very good question. And I think it differs. It's very much something that you work out with yourself, I think. You have to be very self-contained, first of all. Although you're living with, let's say, 25 or 30 other women, it's not like it's a big gab fest or, you know, it's, you know, constant coffee clutch or anything like that. You're living with them like you would live with people in your home. So you eat and sleep among them. You know, everybody's got their own room, so sort of, but and pray and work alongside them. So you're around these people 24/7. So you have to be fairly resilient, And just be disciplined and just know within yourself that you're there for God and you're not there for the other people. So it takes a certain amount of fortitude. Yes, like you said, a devotion to God is kind of critical.
Yeah.
And I think just being at peace with yourself and, you know, obviously if you're somebody who just loves to party or you love to, you know, you crave shopping and things like that, this isn't going to work for you. But it's, on the other hand, it also makes you very aware of the way we do live our lives. And I think that can pull you up short very quickly. When you see, you know, I think sometimes we pride ourselves that we live a fairly virtuous life and so on, and yet when you go into a convent, then you realize just how easy you've had it in your life and how undisciplined you are. And I think we could all do with a little more discipline in many ways too, just disciplining our habits and you know, whether there are, you know, our propensity to eat at all hours of the day and night or watch television or things like that. I think we're just sort of all over the map and we're a little bit aimless these days. So I think the world needs a bit more discipline and a lot more kindness as well.
So did the experience change anything in your life, say? I mean, in terms of your own personal habits?
Well, it certainly did, and I think that whole thing about materialism did. It was... that was a real eye-opener. But the other thing it did, too, was it prompted me to listen more to people and to really listen to them, deeply listen to them, so that, you know, so much of our conversations with one another are so fleeting and so superficial. But in this case, you learn to listen deeply to other people and really not be thinking about what your next answer is going to be or anything. It's just what you can do to make that other person comfortable. It's a little bit hard to explain, but it's about listening more and talking less.
And is there contact with the outside world in terms of say a nun and the work that she might do with regards to members of the church or the community in terms of counseling, teaching, and the sort? Is that part of the day, too?
Again, that depends on the community.
I see.
The ones that I was with were very contemplative communities, and I know there are more active communities of nuns, and I would have liked to have been in those. I mean, I know there are lots who just work among the poor, and they're doing tons and tons of work with the communities, but so there's active nuns, which are the ones who work outside and work in the slums or work in shelters or hospitals and so on, and then there are contemplative nuns who really make prayer the center of their life, and that's all they do is pray.
Now, these nuns that you were amongst, did you get a sense of what compelled them to join monastic life?
Well, some of them I did, and I heard some really interesting stories. I met people who were divorced, so they came out of, you know, a bad divorce, and that was it. They wanted to become nuns. So, you know, there was that story. There was other stories of women at a young age who just wanted to get away from their mothers or their homes and just fled into a convent, and I thought that was rather sad, you know, that was the direction people took. Others happened to be maybe teaching at a school where there were other nuns, and the community of nuns had run a school, and sometimes they brought in secular teachers, and those teachers would, you know, see the nuns in their day-to-day life and then figure that they might like to join up as well and have that, share that kind of life as well. So there's many different reasons why people choose to do it, and it's a very hermit-like existence to some degree, and so you have to want that as well. So I think the reasons are varied, but you know, then there were others who never, ever even thought they would ever become nuns. They thought it was the furthest thing from their minds. And yet, you know, in their mid-40s or something like that, something, a switch went off, and they just decided that that's what they were going to do.
Do you find that young people, young girls, young women, are joining, say, the nunnery, if you will? I mean, I'm sure that as in any business, if you will, where you have, say, boomers, and they're, you know, retiring, dying off, etc. I'm sure that religious life is the same, probably more severe in terms of their numbers, right?
That's true. It is an aging population in convents, for sure. And the issue about succession is a critical one, because you don't have as many young women joining up these days to become nuns. I think in a lot of the Catholic communities, they have more younger nuns joining. But there is a resurgence in religious life now, certainly in England and Wales. I think I read somewhere that vocations are up something like 16 or 18% over the previous year or the previous couple of years. So that's kind of heartening to know. It's interesting. One of the sisters that I had met was telling me that there are usually three points in a person's life, and this goes for men and women, where they make really big changes in their life. And one of them is in their teens, then in their early 20s, and then in around their 40s. So at that point, you make significant shifts in your life or value judgments or changes in how you're going to live your life. And those are sort of the pivotal times when people tend to join convents. So long ago, you used to get lots of women joining in their early 20s, but now society has shifted so much more and things have just changed that it's now women in their 40s and 50s who are joining religious life. And you've got some sisters who are living until they're 80, until they're like 90 or 100 now. So, but really, after about 80, they're not really, they can't really work as like they have. And you do a lot of work in a convent. It is a busy place, and it's a demanding place, too. A lot of them run guest houses, for instance, and they bring in retreats, or they hold retreats and workshops and so on. So it's hugely busy, but after a certain age, you just can't do all that running around anymore.
This is the fourth book, right, that you've written?
Yes, it is.
Yeah. When you I guess you first published The Peely Project, that was about 11 years ago.
Uh-huh.
When that book first came out, did you expect that these books of yours would strike the chord that they have with readers in Canada and beyond?
No, absolutely not. And you know, I always thought it was just going to be a one-off book. And in fact, I didn't even think there was going to be a book at all. And it was only because a couple of friends of mine encouraged me to do it. And I knew nothing about writing a book. But I did it, and it turned into one book, and that was great. And I thought, okay, so that was that. And it wasn't until I was, you know, when the psychic told the pilgrim, and I was probably during the walk itself, and I was probably halfway through the walk when I thought, oh, I think I've got enough material here that I think it would make a really interesting book. And so it just keeps going on and on. It's nothing that's ever planned, but I think at this one, in some ways a very difficult book to write. It took me a long time to do so, and I think in terms of memoir, I think this is about as far as I'm going to go at this point anyway. I'd like to try something different, like try my hand at writing fiction or something.
Well, what is writing about your life or moments from it, I guess, done for the process of memory, remembering, but more importantly, the process of understanding that one does after the events in one's life. I mean, is it a catharsis for you?
Absolutely, it is. In some ways, it's very therapeutic as well. You know, we don't always know. You know, it's really sometimes hard to connect the threads in our lives, and it's you need to sort of sit down and process things. But there's also the issue of, you know, this is the way it is with me, is that it's sometimes very difficult for me to articulate, you know, sort of the events in my life or the way something has affected me. But I can write about it. I can't always talk about it to those who are closest to me. And in fact, this book deals with a part of my life that was very traumatic, and that a lot of my friends will be quite surprised to read it. Probably a lot of my family will be surprised by it as well. So, although it was a difficult thing to write about, it was very therapeutic for me, and I think it helps you grow as a person. But I think you also sort of tap into things that you know, you're not the only one that's going to be contending with something like this. I think the experience that I have in this book, the trauma that I talk about, or the traumatic experience that I talk about, is something that a lot of other people have faced. And in fact, I've already been receiving mail from people who said that, you know, that a similar thing happened to them, and they haven't had the courage to speak up about it.
I can't wait to read this book, as I said earlier. The last book was the trip that you took to Italy with your mother.
Mm-hmm.
What was the fallout from that? I mean, I know that she didn't like the book after she read it.
Yeah, she didn't. And yet her friends couldn't understand why. But I think she just saw it in a totally different light. But it did open up a pathway for us, and we began to talk more honestly to one another, and I think we really helped. It eventually helped repair our relationship, and we became quite close. And the sad thing about it is that my mother passed away at the beginning of this year, and I have felt her loss, you know, just so keenly. And at some point in my life, I know I just saw her as just such a problem for me, and for so long, and now I see what a gift she was to me, and how much I miss her. And I really would have liked to have, I wish she had read this book or been able to read this book, and because both she and my father were really pivotal in instilling the seed of faith in me.
I still remember that picture in the I guess it was in McLean's. The two of you on the sofa there, and
she hated that picture. Oh my gosh, God! She wanted to shoot that photographer. Oh yeah, she was pretty pissed off about that.
It said a lot about the book without even having to read the book. I mean, you could tell that, and I'm sure a lot of people picked up the book just because they saw that. You know?
Yeah. It was a lot of people have problematic relationships with their parents and especially their mother. I certainly heard a lot about a lot from readers about that. So it's not it wasn't an isolated case, but it's a sad one. You know, when you don't get along with a parent, it really is. It's such a big disappointment, you're just always striving to see how you can correct it and how you can change it. And sometimes it can never be changed.
Yeah. Jane, it's been really nice talking again. I can't believe it's been 4 years since we last chatted.
Is that right?
It
has. Is it that long?
Yeah, 2009 was when Incontinent on the Continent came out.
My goodness.
But
wow.
I mean, these books of yours, I mean, they're books that I've been thinking about. Like, I saw that Martin Sheen movie. I thought of your book, and then I went with my mom to Portland last year.
And how did that go?
It was fine, but I mean, she's 60 and I'm 31, so.
Oh my gosh, she's a baby.
Yeah, but I mean, there was a moment we were walking to catch a train or something, And you know how the you know I don't, maybe it's a woman thing. She was just wanting to look at everything as we walked past. And I'm about a block ahead of her, and I'm I remembered, you know, the exact same thing you know used to happen to you, and when you went to Italy with your mom, right?
Yes, that's
so,
right.
So see, these books of yours, you know, they have struck a chord, and certainly with me.
Oh, and, that's wonderful! I'm so glad.
And so good luck with this book.
Thank you very, very much, Joe. It's been a pleasure, as always, speaking to you, and thank you. Thank you for taking the time to talk to me.
You're very welcome. The website, janechristmas.ca, this new book is called And Then There Were Nuns, Adventures in a Cloistered Life. It's published by Greystone. I can't wait to get my hands on it, and I'm sure you will, too. Jane Christmas on the line from Burlington, Ontario, in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.